Blog Talk Radio. This is Love's Outer Limits, and I'm your host, Dr. Amy Marsh, sexologist, hypnotist, lots of other kinds of things, and I'm with my co-host, M. Christian, otherwise known as Chris, erotica writer, sexuality writer, sexual futurist, and also lots of all kinds of other things. We've got a great show lined up for you today, so welcome.
Well, hello, listeners, and good morning, Chris. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm okay. Had a weird night of strange dreams, but managed to get back to sleep. Yeah, really odd. You know, it used to be that the scariest dream you could have practically would be I'm out in public with no clothes on. Oh, no. Well, my dream last night was I'm at a new job and I'm not wearing my mask. It was so strange. Anyway, so shout-outs, you want to start?
Oh, certainly. And it's funny you mention that because we can go on and on about dreams because I've noticed I've been having very much like being with groups of other people dreams, you know, because it's one of the things that you can't do right now.
Wow.
As far as shout-outs go, I mean, the wonderful folks at featureofsex.net are always absolutely fantastic, one of my favorite places to write for. I have articles popping up on hotmovies.com and Kinkly, as well as a bunch of other little places. I'm also doing an erotica writing contest with my pal Ralph Greco for sexpert.com, and that's underway right now. And you get, you know, nice little things like, you know, copies of one of Ralphie's books and then the copy of my new book, Horror Sexual, for that one. But otherwise, just kind of things are perking along.
That sounds good. That sounds good. Wow. Can you talk for another 2 minutes? I'm just getting a text that I need to answer. Now, ordinarily, I wouldn't do this, but it's a real estate question from my real estate agent. So, please go on, and I'm going to text one word to this person. And
sure, no problem. No problem whatsoever. Very good news. I hope it's a good message. It's like, I mean, it's funny. It's like, you know, there's so many things that sort of happening, but sort of not during all this. And as you and I have discussed off the show, it's like, you know, we have a certain degree of fortune that, you know, what we do can be done, you know, remotely. I do worry about people out there who are still, you know, really suffering emotionally and financially, who've had jobs that, you know, can't be done remotely and or are putting themselves out there on the front line. So I want to give, you know, particularly them a huge wave of support and an extra level of one for people who are out there who are keeping this whole country and the world going and putting themselves at risk. So if you are someone who does that as part of your job, I want to say I really appreciate it, and you're doing a magnificent job, and I frankly consider you a hero. So keep up the good work, and don't let people drive you crazy.
That is so wonderful. Yes, thank you. That's absolutely perfect, and I wholeheartedly agree. And, what a time this is. So my shout outs, I guess, are to just being alive. You know, I'm just kind of happy about that right now. I'm going to enjoy it for as long as it lasts. And then aside from that, I note that Disasterina Cybernetic Circus is coming up. I think another episode on Monday. You can find that on YouTube. And one of the nice things about the cybernetic circus is you can tip the performers. So this is one great way to help keep the arts and artists alive by supporting events like this. And whether it's Disasterina and her gang of, you know, amazing drag performers, or, you know, musicians, artists, you know, if there's things you can do to also contribute to GoFundMes or whatever, you know, I think we've all got to share with each other whatever we've got, if we've got some good fortune and something to spare. So I think that's all my shout out today. You know, of course, tickle.life, yay, you know. And
I almost forgot Tickle.
Yeah, oh, no, we can't forget tickle.life. They're doing such great things. And our interview with Shakun last week was really delightful. So our topic today is divine decadence. And I will note that I first heard that phrase from the movie Cabaret, when Liza Minnelli flashes her long green shimmery fingernails at Michael York and blows a puff of cigarette smoke in his face and says, divine decadence. So I just have to say there's some genealogy there in that, you know, in that phrase. I'm sure it wasn't the first time it was used, but it was definitely, that's when it came on my radar. So what is it about that topic, though, that sounds alluring to us right now on this podcast?
Well, personally, I've been sort of like, I have to admit, this is kind of a little bit of a, I don't want to call it kind of a fetish. I've been collecting periods of history where, in my eyes, it felt like, you know, human nature was sort of being experimented with in regards to gender, sex, social structures, art, and so forth. And, you know, technically, I mean, if you look at Wikipedia, which we know is like the flawless tome of all universal knowledge, they really only list like two places for like a decadent, you know, society, not necessarily being a demeaning thing, but things like, you know, the Weimar Republic, which was Germany between the First World War and the Second World War, which of Cabaret takes place in, and the other one being like the decadent artist movement in Britain around the time of Oscar Wilde, which we saw like Audley Beardsley and the Yellow Books and such. But there's been innumerable other times scattered throughout history where sort of the same thing came about, where you have like a really kind of social reevaluation and throwing out of, you know, old customs and things, and being kind of sexually and artistically liberated. I mean, I can rattle off like a dozen off the top of my head.
Well, we'll definitely be wanting to explore all of those. And I want to note that this idea of decadence coupled with, you know, sort of sexual and gender freedom, as well as artistic creativity somehow flowering in new and different directions. It seems to be, we're pretty much going to be talking about that in a Western type context, because I don't know if that phrase or if that, I don't know if it carries well into other cultures that are not, you know, European American, but that's something to, you know, ponder about maybe in another podcast. So just so that we know and our listeners know that this is a slice of the world here, not the entire thing, and a kind of a phenomena, I guess is a word, that somehow seems uniquely Western. Would you agree with that, do you think?
I'm not too sure. I mean, I'm not an expert in other cultures. I do know there have been various times where, you know, again, a little bit of research would probably answer this. I do know, for instance, there's really other fascinating times, like there was the time in the 1800s in Japan, which saw a fusion of Western and traditional Japanese culture. So you saw things like samurai warriors wearing top hats and, the introduction of the steam train, and that could be technically kind of argued, you know, to be sort of like a representation of that kind of like, again, sort of like experimentation. And China at various points, you know, especially in their cities that were around near the border, Hong Kong, you know, Shanghai and so forth, you know, when they sort of like were sort of interspatial, you know, areas could also be part of that. So I honestly think it's necessarily a Western culture thing in and of itself. I do think it's just kind of like some of the, you know, perfect storms that come to mind may just only be Western. But again, I have to plead ignorance.
I think I'm thinking of the term decadence as applied to these kinds of periods as being more Western. Where I'm under is, would these other cultures and other places necessarily use that context? And so that's kind of my focus. You know, they might have other kinds of terminology or other ways of framing the context of, you know, new ideas rushing in or new ideas being generated from within. But the idea of divine decadence always seems to carry a sexual charge, at least for me, when I come across it. And these kinds of periods that you mentioned, there definitely seems to be some sexual new stuff happening that's different, say, from the ordinary conventions of the time. So, would you say that's fair?
Oh, absolutely. And a lot of this is a taxonomy that we're just sort of like, we and other people have sort of like invented, because there's not like a universal. I think sex is a big part of it. And I think it's kind of a key part of it. But a lot of these have a lot, some have less, some are sort of more abstract. So, but I do think a lot of it has to do with just sort of like this kind of spirit of experimentation and hedonism, pleasure and artistic, you know, kind of like bursts of really kind of like interesting and world changing in many ways, you know, kind of like reinventions.
Mm-hmm. Right. And sometimes these things are fueled by maybe just a few people splashing big. Mm-hmm. It may not be an entire culture actively engaged, but the larger culture may be more receptive for some reason. Mm-hmm. And I also think concepts of, you know, bohemian lifestyles, quote unquote, or the demimonde, the little world, you know, these also kind of fold into this idea of decadence, at least, you know, like the type we're talking about. Let's talk about what's your fave?
Well, I have a couple of classic favorites. I mean, and it's really interesting. Some of these don't last for very long. There doesn't seem to be like a pervasive length of these kind of bohemian, you know, decadent kind of period. They only seem to last for a couple of decades, if not smaller. But my favorite one, of course, is the Weimar Republic, which was just like, it was very much kind of I wouldn't actually call it a positive, because many people were like, there's drug addiction, there's rampant non-consensual sex work, there was all kinds of other things, but it was also an artistic and gender and sexuality explosion. Everything from, you know, you mentioned before, Cabaret and, you know, Bertolt Brecht and everybody else. And then there's also the Oscar Wilde years, which was Audrey Beardsley, the Yellow Book again, you know, Oscar himself. But there's also other ones. I mean, it could be really argued, I think, that, you know, the 1950s and, you know, the what was called in William S. Burroughs' book, Interzone, which was the international zone in Tangiers, Morocco. And even could be argued San Francisco in the 60s, New York in the 70s. And you have other areas like, for instance, just after the first French Revolution, there was a period between that and the Terror where French society was basically being rewritten, and they did all kinds of things like, you know, increased rights for women, sexual experimentation, you know, throwing out religious institutions. It was really quite fascinating. And one of my personal favorites is the period of the club years in Great Britain, which is around 1750, something like that, where you had all these kind of bacchanalian clubs emerging. And one of the most famous ones is the Amorous Knights of Wycombe, which is run by Sir Francis Dashwood. And that one often is referred to as a Hellfire Club, though technically they never actually called it that.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I've heard you mention the Hellfire Club before. Right. I'm thinking, too, of you know, Paris in the 30s, you know, with Anna Eastman mm-hmm. and Henry Miller and a lot of the mm-hmm. other artists and writers who were there at the time. I'm thinking too of the Bloomsbury Group in England, you know, so we've got E.M. Forster and Virginia Woolf and Clive Bell and a bunch of other folks. I came across a really great quote attributed to Dorothy Parker about the Bloomsbury Group or the Bloomsbury set. And these were intellectuals, writers, philosophers, artists. So the first half of the 20th century, but mainly before the 30s. But Dorothy Parker said they lived in squares, painted in circles, and loved in triangles. And I thought that was pretty cute. And then I mentioned to South Serena a minute ago, and you mentioned the Weimar Republic. And I just want to say that I saw this incredible video that she did called Why Won't You?, which was like a vintage Weimar Republic cabaret act. It was hysterical. It was so well done. And I just thought, oh my God, this person has stepped from, you know, the stages of history to come out and do this performance. And it's very recent. So on YouTube, Disasterina, Why Won't You? And it's a scream. So a lot of us are still kind of referencing or channeling, I don't know, we're affected by this. Beatniks in the 50s, hippies in the 60s, you know, I mean, all the stuff that mm-hmm. we can think of, different enactments of different pagan, you know, pagan, I don't want to say lifestyle, I hate that word, but, you know, pagan groups that would form would often have a sexual component, like the Church of All mm-hmm. in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of stuff. But what is it right now that makes us want to talk about these people or yearn for a life that somehow resonates? Let's explore that
personally,
a little bit.
Certainly, and I also want to throw out a couple of other little thoughts really quickly. One other place would be like New Orleans in the 1800s, San
right.
Francisco, the Barbary Coast years.
Right.
There's also an author named Mel Gordon who's written a series of books, and I don't want to say that they're not good. I thought that they were effective, but there might be a good reference for people who are interested in this kind of thing. He wrote one book called Horizontal Collaboration, which is on the erotic world of Paris from the 1920s to 1946. And he wrote, you know, speaking of, once again, the Weimar Republic, he also wrote one called Voluptuous Panic, which covered that era as well. So those, you know, if you want good references, those are kind of, you know, kind of fun ones. And there's many books written about all these various time periods. You know, even the Studio 54 years in New York would definitely qualify.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's like but my particular fascination with these little periods of history is that for me, it kind of shows that, you know, it's so often looked at history as being this kind of homogeneous engine of, you know, for lack of a better word, conformity. And I love these little bursts of, you know, wild creativity around sex, gender, and the arts. And it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like showing another side of humanity that I just find, you know, quite alluring and in many ways very positive. I mean, there's definitely very big drawbacks to many of these societies. I mentioned before, drug addiction, you know, non-consensuality, sex work, you know, all those kind of things that were, you know, I mean, non-consensual sex work that were very negative. But at the same time, I just think it's really interesting that it's like humanity sort of like steps aside for a couple of decades and says, you know, do as thou will. And many, I think it shows that this kind of thing can actually happen again and is happening probably, you know, in many ways right now. I just think it is being a very positive thing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I do too. I don't see it so much as humanity stepping out of the way of people as people come burbling up in the crevices and create these little nooks and crannies. You know, maybe it's a little different with the Weimar Republic because that seemed to have had the flavor of the era and the place. But I think in other cases, like when we're talking about these clusters of writers and artists and musicians and so on, they make their own little bubble and then they do all kinds of things within that bubble, but it's still not that acceptable. But they end up serving as beacons, for example, maybe to younger people, younger generations coming up. Mm-hmm. I think these things happen in different ways. I've always thought about kind of what I call the bohemian continuum, you know, that there's, mm-hmm. that there's this thread. Sometimes we can find it easily, sometimes not, but that it kind of goes through and we can tug on it even now and discover things and find our connections with these different things. So are there, say, historical people that you're particularly fascinated by that come out of some of these different periods that you've looked at?
Well, we mentioned a couple offhand. I mean, Oscar Wilde is a good example. Bertolt Brecht is another one. Audrey mm-hmm. Beardsley is another one. I know I'm forgetting dozens and dozens. William S. Burroughs, Mary Pranksters, you know.
Oh, yeah.
The Factory, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry?
Oh, yeah. Ken Kesey.
You know, the
right.
Factory Years in New York is another good example. You know, so there's always like these things, these kind of movements, and this is kind of a generalization, seem often to be fueled by the art. They're fueled by a sense of liberation, but there's also like kind of an artistic, I don't know what to call it, kind of a thread, like you mentioned before, or a theme. I mean, you mentioned Arthur Miller, Annis Nin, you know, all these authors and writers and musicians, and, you know, jazz, of course, in the 20s, you know, was this kind of like kind of artistic motivator in some ways.
Yeah, and I mentioned Henry Miller, not Arthur Miller, just as a correction.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, it was Henry and Anna Eads who, you know, had their literary and sexual fling. But, yeah, I mean, there's tons and tons of people we could look at. Isadora Duncan, for example, might be a great example because she was definitely a free spirit. And her dance mm-hmm. was unusual given the times. I mean, there's so many people. I know I loved growing up. I loved Aubrey Beardsley. I wanted to draw like Aubrey Beardsley, or somehow maybe not exactly like him, but he was very much an influence on my artwork mm-hmm. during that time. I loved reading the diaries of Anna Eads Nin. I liked hearing about Paris in the 30s. I liked Oscar Wilde. There's all kinds of stuff. You know, they made me feel like I was at home when I would come across mm-hmm. these different works. I think that's a big thing. It's just sort of like, yeah, there's other people like there out there that have been like me, that are like me. Being like me is okay. Solace for weirdos.
I agree with you. I agree with you 100%. I mean, I've always kind of like had this deep emotional uncomfortability with this kind of 2.5 family unit, you know, model of what, you know, what often feels like society is kind of like pigeonholed into of, you know, it's like, you know, a binary, you know, a, you know, work focused, or I should say money focused existence, and where sex is not discussed and experimentation is frowned upon. And it's really kind of uplifting and very positive to realize that there's like these little bursts of, you know, of experimentation and joy and hedonism and experimentation and all these different kind of like very creative little explosions that, you know, sort of like you mentioned before, bubble up from the cracks. And I just think it's very, very optimistic that it's like it sort of shows that, you know, this, it doesn't have to be these way. And even though these little bursts don't last very long, it's often because of outside forces that they come, sort of collapse. I also want to give a shout out to one of my favorite, you know, artistic things was the Grand Guignol theater in Paris, which existed from the 1890 or so until, believe it or not, 1960. But that was another thing. I love that kind of period. And I mentioned before Bertolt Brecht. I mentioned, like, you know, Franz Gostens, all these other, you know, authors and creators who just, I think, you know, just really just magnificent. And I just love those little, like, you know, reinventions of all kinds of things. And it's also interesting that, you know, it was also like the Olympia Press, which was, I think it's Olympia, and I apologize if I got that wrong, who actually was daringly published, you know, James Joyce's Ulysses. And they're mostly known for being erotica or a smut bug peddler. And there's all kinds of other little examples of that one. I mean, that Audrey Beardsley documentary we just saw recently, you know, they mentioned that there was like an explosion of erotic fiction and artwork during that period, to the point where I think there was a bookstore in Paris that even had a sign that said, you know, we are the place for smut, or something like this.
I remember that.
I mean, you know, Toulouse-Lautrec. I mean, there's like this whole like explosion of just wonderful, you know, creativity and experimentation. And there's also even situations where, you know, oddly as it sounds, that sometimes it's like human, you know, people became like lightning rods for this. I mean, Oscar Wilde, beyond his genius as a writer and a playwright, he was also kind of like a figurehead of this. And there's others as well. I mean, I just lost, unfortunately, the name. Let me try to look it up here really quickly. Who was a very famous like performer, and just her entire life was like an explosion of Anita Berber, that's it. And who's been described as Berlin's priestess of depravity. But she definitely wasn't the only one.
Oh, wow. Wow. I don't know anything about her. Now I'm intrigued. I'm going to have to look her up. You can find a lot of good accounts of what was going on in Europe, particularly in Paris, too, from Janet Flanner, who wrote for The New Yorker, Letters from Paris, under the name of Genet. Fantastic writing in and of itself, and then lots and lots of wonderful stories and anecdotes about different people in the arts doing their different things. But I think what I really envy is when I come across an account of, you know, say one of these little pockets or bubbles, and there's a tight-knit community. And for better or worse, you know, that can be hellish or it can be wonderful. But I really envy these clusters of people who have somehow been able to get together. And you get the feeling that there's synergy in what they're doing, not just sexuality and what's going on, but that they're actually kind of boosting each other, either through dialogue or the experiences they're sharing. Maybe the feeling that it's them against the world. You know, it's, I really envy that. I personally am very alone. I don't really have people that I would consider, not in proximity anyway, artistic and philosophical colleagues. Everybody's far away. So there isn't this, oh, come over, let's have dinner and talk revolution, or let's talk art, let's talk sex, you know, let's get up to some shenanigans. You know, that's not there in my life. And I'm sad about that.
Well, I feel the same way. I mean, you know, I do think it's like, I'm not too sure if it's like, I mean, right now, of course, it's really hard to talk about this because we can't do anything in public. I mean, even if we could find a community, we couldn't actually join them, you know, obviously because of the current pandemic. But it's still, it's like, you know, me, the eternal optimist, I do think it's still possible these things will emerge. And it could be argued that the temporary trauma zone in Seattle that recently happened was sort of a quasi-example of that. But I do think it's also, it's interesting, I think we see now more than anything virtual versions of what you're talking about. I mean, you mentioned Disasterina and the whole, you know, queer fluid, the gender fluid, you know, drag performer kind of intersection there. I think it's kind of like a common example of that. But yeah, it's like we kind of miss that kind of directly personal touch. And you're right, it's like a lot of these places were very, very intimate. where everybody seemed to literally know everybody else. If you talk about like the Oscar Wilde years, it's like, you know, Oscar knew like everybody. And the same way, like, you know, once again, I mentioned like, you know, Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters or the Factory years in New York, everybody literally just sort of like, you know, if they didn't know them, then they're one degree of separation. And again, you know, Paris in the 20s and so forth. I mean, everybody, you know, was sort of like connected in very often direct ways. You know, it's always love hearing about those kind of things where, like, I think I read somewhere that, we just mentioned her, famous Folies Bergère performer. I'm just having a brain fart. She did the banana dance. I'm completely drawing a
blank. Josephine Baker.
Thank you. I don't know why I had a brain fart. Josephine Baker was a lover of Frida Kahlo.
Right.
You know, so it's like it really was this really intimate, very kind of like, you know, very sexual, kind of very dynamic. And, you know, that's just one of many. I just think that's absolutely wonderful and fantastic. I'm not sure if we'll have it again. I think we will. I think right now it's kind of hard to do that because we obviously can't get together. But I do think in some ways there are like the internet sort of spawning its own little, you know, decadent pockets. But I do hope it returns. I really don't think it's going to go away. I think this is kind of a very human thing. And, you know, some of the listeners out there are probably thinking, well, that's, you know, my city right now or, you know, something similar. And, you know, in some ways, there's some places where this is almost sort of continued. There's a very famous, I'm going to look it up really quick here so I don't want to get it wrong. There's actually an anarchist community. Give me a second where I type in the internet.
Sure.
I know it's fascinating to listen
in
to.
In the United States? Or
no,
elsewhere?
It's actually
that
located
you're talking
in
about?
Denmark. It's called Christiania, uh-huh. I think it's called. And
okay.
It was started, I think, in the 1960s or 70s, and I think it's still there. I heard recently that they tried to shut it down, but it's basically a permanent, self-governing little part of a city.
Oh, that sounds like so much fun. I hope you can find what that's called. There was something I was going to mention while you were talking, and now I have had my own sort of little forgetfulness moments here. That's not so great. Oh, but you know what I can do while you're looking it up? I can say, guests, listeners, if you want to call in, you can call us and talk about Divine Decadence at 516-531-9238. And that is 516-531-9238. Okay, Chris, take it away. You found
it's called Freetown Christiania, which I'll spell Christiania. It was as part of, it's in Denmark. Is it right? It's actually it's a borough of Copenhagen, and it started in 1971 and basically kind of governed itself until, unfortunately, around like the 2000s. It's sort of like, you know, they had some like, you know, stress and strain and such, but it was its own little pocket, sort of self-governing little part of the city. And in fact, they even had one of the things they had was what's called the Gay House, which was 1970s, and it was an institution that sort of like self-perpetuated in the area that put on like was known for gay activism, parties, theater, you know, and so forth. So that's a perfect example, you know. And so it was like it just sort of like, you know, remained there for well into the 2000s. So I think that's actually a perfect example that, you know, this doesn't really have to be like a short-term thing, though unfortunately, like all of them, it's been, you know, since, you know, changed. And now, according to Wikipedia, again, the source of all knowledge, you know, the Danish law now applies there. So I get sort of loss of autonomy. But still, it's like it shows these things can actually go on for quite a while. So I think it's kind of interesting both how these things emerge and how they also end. Sometimes it's things that was not actually focused on them, though it could be argued that, you know, the Nazis' rise to power, you know, was based on this, you know, reactionary, you know, view of what was happening during the Weimar Republic. You know, the very famous, like, exhibition of paintings by the Nazis about decadent art, for instance. Paris less so. Paris just simply got steamrolled by the Second World War, because the Paris authorities never really, you know, actively did it. The international zone in Tangiers was sort of tolerated, and it just kind of like time moved beyond it. But in many ways, it's kind of like sad, but it seems like these little pockets often either end of their own just running out of steam, which I think is less common, but more common because suddenly it's like people seem to like get uncomfortable with it. I mean, look at the Oscar Wilde years. I'm sorry for going into lecture mode here, but the Oscar Wilde, you know, years of decadence was ended pretty much when Oscar was arrested, you know, for sodomy. And it's almost like, you know, this was accepted sort of like in a sort of like, let's not talk about it way, but the incident became public. The whole world was basically shut down.
Right. Well, people didn't want it to happen to them. They didn't want their fun to be exposed and then to get in trouble for it. Of course, I think sometimes what happens is political. Sometimes it's legal. And sometimes I think people's egos also get in the way, especially if you've got a smaller, close-knit group. You may have people who are going along for a while and everything's peachy, and then maybe somebody's too much of a toxic, charismatic leader, or, you know, there's been a super acrimonious breakup, and then all of a sudden people just aren't, you know, willing to get together in the same way anymore. Those things happen too. Competition, professional jealousy, as well as romantic jealousy. I mean, people are people. But a lot of times, you know, they're at least in the initial stages, if people weren't sleeping together, they were passing out on each other's couches and things like that. So there was a kind of intimacy and, you know, just sharing life in a way that's outside, you know, as you said earlier, the classic post-war American nuclear family model, you know, whole different kind of thing, chosen family and so on. Well, I'm going to invite callers one more time. So 516-531-9238. And I'm hearing a whooshing fan. I don't know where that's coming from. But once again, 516-531-9238. If anybody wants to call, offer some people that we haven't thought of. Like earlier you were talking, and I thought, oh, Kenneth Anger, we've got to mention him. I mean, there's so many people we haven't mentioned. It's ridiculous. But, you know, so there would be people who would either create art films or maybe films that somehow document something about the movement or the time, plays. Can't think of one in particular, but I know that people, playwrights, were using this material and dealing with it. Gosh, I ought to be able to think of at least one play. Because going to plays was a big deal. That used to be like the social thing that people did in Europe, was they would go to a play and they would see the latest, you know, scandalous thing by Oscar Wilde, for example. I mean, there's our playwright right there. Let's see.
Bertolt Brecht again. I mean, the Grand Guignol is another example. I mean, you know, theater was a major part of it. But of course, it's like when you think about it, theater is a perfect example because you're mixing literary, artistic, and, you know, actors, which is always a wonderful, sexy, and volatile combination. So anywhere you mix, you know, mix in that thing, it's gonna sort of explode.
Right. Yeah. I remember in my teens, I was part of this political group called Tuesday the Ninth Committee, and there was some of the people that were kind of on the periphery of that group, which was, you know, as I say, it was a political group, very leftist. It was started by students of Herbert Marcuse at UCSD. But there was Theater 5, which would put on these revolutionary plays like America Hurrah, and we would go see them, of course. And then there was the Tiny Orc Bookstore. And the owner of that bookstore, Terry Ork, ended up being super influential in the New York punk scene later on. So there's some interesting, you know, cross-fertilizations and overlap that happen. But I remember watching America Hurrah as performed by Theater 5 and just thinking that I was, it wasn't sexy, but it was stirring because it was kind of, you know, that scathing portrayal of American life, you know, that we were all hungry for because we didn't want to go that route. And that's exciting and it's stimulating, you know, as a, you know, especially if you're a younger person watching what the people slightly older than you are doing. Let's see, what else? Burlesque, I think, can be, especially neo-burlesque these days, it's very much got that little decadence to it, the kind of neo-vaudevillian stuff that goes on, different kind of roadshow type acts. People like, I'm thinking of bands that were active a few years ago, like the March 4th marching band or Mutator, you know, that would have these enormous shows mixing circus arts and burlesque and I don't know how many musicians and a lot of drumming and all kinds of stuff, you know, very, very, very fun and like Dresden Dolls, who always had their brigade of fans who would sometimes be invited to put things on themselves, you know, before the Dresden Dolls came on stage themselves. I mean, there's invitations like that, you know, there's invitations for participation. Sometimes people trying to make community. I wonder sometimes, though, I'm going to sound really stodgy, but if people would get off their cell phones, maybe more of this stuff could happen. It drives me crazy. You know, people are texting instead of making art and revolution and love. But, you know, that's me being bitter. I'm going to be very bitter.
Well, one thing that just crossed my little mind was that, you know, it's like some of these things are actually, it's like some of these things have continued up to a very recent time. I mentioned like the temporary Thomas Zone in Seattle, though that one I think was more like a political than necessarily a sexual and gender and artistic, though I'm not discounting anything that came about during that period or, you know, anything that can come from it. But if you look also at things like, you know, you mentioned like, you know, performers and, you know, this kind of thing, there's actually like, you know, in some ways, like, the, you know, people who followed everything from the Grateful Dead to something similar. But we still see, I mean, we don't see it right now because of the pandemic, but we still, you know, it's still there, I think. And it just sometimes doesn't get on the radar. You know, a good example would be look at, like, the Cacophony Society in San Francisco for a while. And even, like, you know, the days of, like, you know, the, once again, the 70s and 80s in San Francisco, when you have, like, you know, back when I was there in the 90s, it felt very kind of decadent because, once again, it was like the birth of this new erotica thing. And, you know, there was like a sex party every weekend and such. But also like the early days of like Burning Man, which now has become kind of like commercialized and kind of pasteurized. But when it first started out, it was very underground. And it was very kind of like the only way you knew about these kind of events was by a network of other people, which always kind of focused on art and music and performance. But it didn't any have any, you know, offhand like leading lights like some of these other ones. I still think it was like generated by the same kind of impetus. And we still have some examples of it. I mean, I always get this mixed up, and you always remember, and I never do. Is it the Oregon County Fair or the Oregon State Fair?
Oregon Country
Fair. Which I haven't.
Country.
The Country Fair is a good example. The Country Fair feels even, of course, this is not happening this year, but it has always kind of felt like that resurgence of 60s, you know, peace, love, creativity, which lasted, which still, I mean, except for this year, has been going on forever. I mentioned before that, you know, Thomas Zone in Denmark is a good example. So I do think it's like they're still there. I think right now it's hard to, like, envision them because of the current pandemic, but I do think it's one of those things I think just will pop up. I do think as we go forward, it may be again, more subcultural than geographic. I mean, that's the one thing about the age of the internet is we've lost the need for things to be physically located. So, you know, I'm probably talking, you know, anyone's listening to the show will probably be thinking, oh, that describes my group of, you know, artistic, musical, literary, genderqueer, experimentational, you know, circle that just is happens, you know, on some, you know, site or through virtual reality or Zoom or something similar. So I do think it's still going to be around. And, you know, if you look at, like, you know, how often it happens and how recently it's happened, I do think this is definitely something that's not going to go away anytime soon.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's part of what happens when you're a human being. You either get to be, oh, I'm going to sound so bitter again, but you get to be either part of the really thoughtless, destructive consumer society, or you get to be somebody who breaks out from that in some way and tries very hard to create and live in a different kind of reality, however that's framed. And there's a lot of ways of doing that, both, you know, some can be very unhealthy and not real great for other people around, and other things can be, you know, just joyous and fun. When I was a teenager, again, I'm going back to my teen years, but I did have a whole group of friends, and we did everything together. We camped, we slept, and we just had, like, mass slumber parties. We just kind of floated from to different people's houses. You know, we were in that political group together, a lot of us. And, you know, that was maybe as close to Bloomsbury, you know, as I ever got in terms of real life. Because there was, yeah, you know, I mean, we were teenagers. We had hormones, you know, different partners, partnered up with other different people sometimes. But it was really exhilarating. It was fun. We appreciated each other's creativity. We, you know, people had no problems bringing out an instrument and playing something, or people didn't have a problem sitting there drawing. And it was just super nice. I think it's a very natural way of just kind of flowing into that different kind of sense mm-hmm. of things. There was something else I was going to bring up, though. Wow. Okay. Well, it flew away and it might not come back. I'm going to ask guests one more time. You know, listeners, you can call in at 516-531-9238. So, yeah, it's hard to imagine a post-COVID world where these things could happen in physical proximity. It is very difficult at this point.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I had my own little taste back in San Francisco. As we talked about before, I think this is something we probably could do a whole show on, is San Francisco at various times has had this kind of same thing. I mean, when I was there in the 90s, you know, it was, you know, very much, I mean, we had like Black Sheets zine, we had like the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence with the Black Leathering Fairies. You know, there was literally like a, you know, a BDSM or sex party every weekend. You know, you had, you know, writers like, you know, Pat Califia, Carol Queen, we're still around, of course. I mean, I'm just talking about, we're all in proximity at that time. So, you know, it very much kind of felt like a little sliver of that. I think it was kind of like, because of the you know, AIDS epidemic, it was kind of like, you know, kind of down-tooled a little bit, but it certainly didn't stop us from, you know, like I said, putting on a party every week, or, you know, attending the SM flea market, or, you know, and there was really wonderful cross-pollination during that time too, because, you know, it was kind of this intersectionality of, like, you had like the BDSM world, then you had like a cacophony society, then you had the Black Leather Fairies, then you had, you know, the various queer, you know, sex and BDSM groups that would all kind of like merge together. So, you know, we'd do things like, you know, one weekend we'd go to the Cacophony Society, who are having, you know, Alice in Wonderland tea party, serving like, you know, mushroom tea. And then, mm-hmm. you know, the next day we'd be attending a party at the 15, which is a queer male, you know, BDSM group that would occasionally open up their parties to other people, which was very, very touching, I thought. So, you know, that was quite an interesting experience. And again, I think a lot of it is funny, because a lot of it, I think, is based on accessibility of being able to express yourself. I mean, it's funny because a lot of the other things we see very often, not universally, in these kind of, you know, pop-ups, these little eruptions, is that you can do it. In other words, Paris in the 20s was cheap. Weimar Republic was ridiculous because the economy collapsed. So, you know, you could do things without having to make $1 million. And I think the San Francisco scene collapsed because of the greed of the dot-com, you know, explosion, just sort of kicked out all the artists and weirdos and so forth. So, you know, these times were always kind of based around the kind of a sense of economic freedom, you know, where, you know, because you didn't need to, you know, constantly be making a huge amount of money, you could live very simply and be able to be yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I got to San Francisco in 1976. So I got there for the best part of the whole punk rock scene early on at the Mabuhay Gardens. And then other clubs every now and then would feature punk acts. But the Mabuhay was really, you know, absolutely number one. So I was there for lots of music. And there was Project Artaud, which was a place that housed a lot of artists, you know, living in warehouses. There were lots of warehouse parties. Things would just take place at, you know, 3 a.m. and you could see Romeo Void or, some of the other, like, really cool bands that were playing at the time, Rhythm and Noise. Just, like, so many. And then there was Mark Pauline with the robots. There was a lot of stuff going on. And as you say, you know, it was very do-it-yourself. You didn't have a lot of money, but you just sort of scrambled up whatever you could do. And I was doing vinyl wearable art. And I was putting on fashion shows. And I would just kind of get people together and get some other designers together, and we'd find some models, and we'd find somebody to do their hair and their makeup, and then we'd put on a show. And my first one was actually at the Mabuhay, and it was, I might have told this story before on the air, because I know we have had at least one episode where we reminisced a little bit about San Francisco, but, you know, it was back in the day, so of course I had somebody wearing a jock strap for a mouse, carrying a chainsaw, attacking a TV set on stage. You know, I mean, it's just like, that's what you did back then. And mm-hmm. But it was so much fun because you could, it's just like, I mean, I remember when The Clash played San Francisco, we didn't find out through any sort of actual advertising. It just got sprayed on the walls, you know. Clash, Temple Beautiful, you know, and there you'd go. And so these were really exciting and at times that gestated a lot of stuff. You know, a lot of people did things. And some people didn't survive. Some people went on to do other sorts of things like I did. But it was a great time. A great time to be in San Francisco and around all the creative people. So, there's some nostalgia creeping in case listeners, you can't tell. But, you know, that happens. I wonder what can happen now, you know, if there's anything besides the internet, like, I don't know. I'd love to find something that was that's somewhere between, I don't know. I know we're going to have to deal with COVID for a long, long time, but I'd love to see something that was safe and healthy, but also not just online. And I honestly don't know what that could be. We'll see. I guess people will figure these things out.
Well, I know personally, it's like, again, I'm kind of the eternal optimist, mainly because I think it's like, otherwise it'll just drive me crazy. I do like to think that we actually might see an evolution in, you know, in this kind of thing manifesting as, like, again, online communities. I would really like to see, and this is something I fantasize about actually putting together, though, once again, you know, there's other things that are kind of taking priority right now, would be something like, an ARG, which is an alternative reality game, where basically it's like they're often used to promote like books and movies and such, which is basically kind of a synthetic reality where you get text messages or receive letters or, you know, sometimes even physically go out to locations to sort of tie the story together. I would love to see something like that be integrated into, you know, something like a decadent movement, like creating a whole, you know, basically a virtual Paris in the 20s, or, you know, again, digital version of Weimar Republic, where, you know, you would just like, you know, tune into like your, you know, stage performance, or, you know, watching a movie together, or, you know, sharing weird stories and such, but have it come be in a little more cohesive manner. So it wouldn't be like little picking and choosing from little places. It would be like you would just go to a website or something similar. The curtain would part, there'd be the performer, and you could, you know, interact that way or something similar. And I do think that is something that you know, could be created. I just simply don't have the time right now to do it, but it is a very fun fantasy. I do think that spirit of what we're talking about is it's eternal. I mean, I think we, even though these things sometimes end tragedy, you know, tragically, I do think that it's a part of a really wonderful and special part of human nature, that we have these little explosions that sort of say, you know, once again, it's like, why not? And do as thou will, and, you know, let's have fun, and let's make and fuck, and, you know, just, you know, be, you know, kind of like change what, you know, our expectations of human nature is. And I think that's really very special.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think all we really need, Chris, is we need that tech person to come on board with us, so we could start making one of these things, because I do like that idea. I think it's a good one. So if there's any tech listeners out there, so what kind of programming, or what would you call a person who is able to make that kind of virtual reality? Is there a specific title?
Well, I think a lot of these things, it's simply a matter of, I mean, nowadays it's like, I mean, this is a whole different show in and of itself, is that, the, you know, creating this stuff isn't all that difficult. There's a certain skill set that's required, like self-publishing is a good example of a parallel. But I do think it's just a matter of finding, you know, a bunch of people who are committed and making it happen, because there's a lot of off-the-shelf things you can do to create this. There's all kinds of, like, virtual reality, you know, online game platforms, you know, forums, you know, Wikipedia style sites, I mean, video conferencing services, all this stuff just simply has to be sort of like, you know, assembled and put together. But it's just, again, you know, we're dealing with a pandemic, and the social isolation is part of it, but also a lack of motivation is another. We're all really kind of numb. But I would definitely, if anybody's out there listening to this who wants to, you know, think about doing this, I am totally game, because I think it would be fun, I think it would be important, and I think it's something that could give us a really kind of sense of, like, looking at the current pandemic and how we're all feeling, a good kind of voice, and sort of like be supportive.
Well, and I think it's a way for us to imagine the world that we really need to have made, you know, the old ones falling apart. This is a great opportunity to really envision what needs to happen. But we are getting to the top of our hour, and so I think it's time for us to say goodbye. We're going to be talking about fantasies next week, which is, you know, like the kind of topic you can go on forever about. There's a lot to say and a lot to share. But Chris, thank you so much. And listeners, thank
always
you for
delightful,
listening.
Always delightful.
Yeah, and hey, folks, tell your friends, you know, share the podcast with them, listen to it afterwards, you know, give us some love. We'd enjoy that. So anyway, we're going to say goodbye. See you next week. Chris, take care. We'll be talking. And, yeah, happy rest of Saturday to you all. Bye-bye.
This is Love's Outer Limits, and I'm your host,